Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
August 216 BC. After his victory at Cannae, Hannibal seemed to be the master of Italy. He never could have guessed that 14 years later, Rome would force him to fight for his life and his country's on a battlefield in Africa. Even less credible, the commander of that Roman army would be one of the survivors of the disaster at Cannae. How did it happen? And what took place on that day in 202 BC when Hannibal had to struggle to save everything? It was one of history's decisive battles, although it's hardly a household word today. It was Zama. And the man who faced Hannibal was Publius Cornelius Scipio, last seen as a young military tribune, that is, colonel, rallying Roman survivors after Cannae at a nearby city. We'll get to Zama presently, but first, let's take a look at the aftermath of Cannae. After the fighting ended at Cannae on August 2, 216, Hannibal's officers surrounded him with congratulations. Most of them called for a well-deserved rest, but not Maharbal, Hannibal's commander of cavalry. Maharbal advised an immediate attack on Rome. In 4 days, he said, Hannibal could be dining on the capital, Rome's citadel. Maharbal offered to go first with his horsemen. Hannibal declined. It was not so easy a thing to do, he said, and besides, he needed time to reflect. Maharbal is supposed to have replied, "Assuredly, no one man has been blessed with all God's gifts. You know how to be the victor, Hannibal, but not how to use your victory." The famous Latin goes like this, "Vincere scis Hannibal, victoria uti ne scis." Was Maharbal right? At the time, Hannibal disagreed. He thought this army was too tired, that it would take several weeks, not 4 days, to reach Rome, and that the walls of Rome were too strong for him to take the city. Besides, he expected the Romans to be reasonable after Cannae and to seek terms of surrender. Years later, however, Hannibal reconsidered. Rome, in fact, did not surrender, but fought on. He realized that by marching on Rome after Cannae, he might have persuaded a panicked city into negotiating. He might at least have got some of Rome's allies in central Italy to join him. Instead, Hannibal turned his efforts into trying to reconquer Sicily, a strategy that failed. Hannibal had underestimated Rome's resilience, its determination, and its adaptability. Still, even an unsuccessful Hannibal remained dangerous, and he kept his army in Italy for 15 years. He was a sufficiently good leader that he never suffered a mutiny. That, however, was not enough to win the war. Rome soon produced a general who was able to learn from Hannibal's tactics and apply them to the Roman military. He was Publius Cornelius Scipio. Scipio came from an elite military and political family, but he was not hidebound by tradition. He was shrewd, innovative, and a survivor, literally, as he lived on through the carnage of Cannae and rallied the other soldiers who had made it through. They elected him to be their commander. Scipio proceeded to rethink the way Rome fought wars, making the legions more flexible and embracing cunning and ruse. It's so important in the face of defeat to have leaders who are willing to rethink, to admit mistakes, and to start all over again. And Scipio was the man for the hour. The great historian Polybius labeled Scipio, quote, "perhaps the most illustrious man of any born before the present generation," end quote. Scipio was self-assured and highly intelligent. He was a natural leader. Sober and religious, he used omens and the divine to encourage his men. Like Hannibal, he was a master of military surprise. Polybius says that Scipio was very brave in battle, but he underlines other qualities of the man's greatness. I'm going to read a few quotations. First, that everything Scipio did was done with calculation and foresight, and that all his enterprises fell out as he had reckoned will be clear from what I am about to say. Second quotation, it's generally agreed that Scipio was beneficent and magnanimous, but that he was also shrewd and discreet with a mind always concentrated on the object he had in view. Well, that would be conceded by none except those who associated with him and to whom his character stood clearly revealed. So to know the man well, you really had to get close to him. And now the third quote, which Polybius writes, Scipio indeed possessed a particular talent for inspiring confidence and sympathy in his troops when he called upon them. Both Scipio's father and uncle were killed in action against the enemy in Spain. Because of not just his pedigree, but his promise, Scipio received the command as their successor, in spite of the Romans' preference for older and more mature men in such positions. He did not disappoint. At the age of only 26, Scipio captured New Carthage, the Carthaginian capital of Spain. He took the place by a cunning, careful, and very well thought out plan to which he'd given a lot of attention in advance. His success there shocked the world. In the following years, Scipio proceeded to win two great battles against Carthaginian armies and to drive Carthage from Spain, its most important possession. Hannibal is one of the most admired, most romantic, and most tragic military leaders in history. Hannibal took staggering risks that bore spectacular fruit, only to see everything turn sour in the end. Scipio is one of the most daring, cunning, and successful generals in history. But when it comes to the history books, he stands in Hannibal's shadow. Scipio plays Wellington to Hannibal's Napoleon. Or perhaps Scipio plays Grant to Hannibal's Lee, because there's a real analogy between the Punic Wars, especially the Second Punic War and the American Civil War. In both conflicts, one side pitted dash and dazzle on the battlefield against a duller but more disciplined state with greater staying power. In both cases, slow but steady won the race. Thanks to Scipio, Rome conquered Spain and drove Carthage out from what had been the jewel in its crown. Scipio's next move was diplomatic, and it was a coup. He won over the Numidian prince Massinissa to the side of Rome. Now, Numidia, you'll remember, was an African country, roughly the equivalent of today's Algeria. Now, Carthage fought back and initiated a domestic struggle involving different factions in Numidia as to who would come out on top and whether Numidia would be an ally of Carthage or Rome. In the end, Rome won, and Numidia came out solidly on its side. Now, this was very important, and the reason was that Numidia had the world's best light cavalry. You remember at Cannae how the Carthaginians trapped the Roman army by taking out Rome's cavalry and surrounding the Romans by the Carthaginian cavalry, making retreat impossible. It was the Numidian light cavalry who had played the key role there. So given the importance of Numidia's cavalry to Carthage's warfighting abilities, Scipio's move was a game changer, and a Carthaginian could only shudder at the prospect that those fantastic horsemen would now be on the side of the enemy. And having made that move, Scipio invaded North Africa in 204 BC. As a result, he forced Hannibal to leave Italy. And the next year, 203, after 15 years in enemy country, Hannibal finally sailed back to Africa, a place he hadn't seen since he was a boy, since he had spent his earlier career in Spain. After landing in Africa in autumn 203 BC, Hannibal spent about a year building up his army. He made his base outside a seaport about 75 miles southeast of Carthage. This was a place where Hannibal's family owned property and he had connections. At this distance, Hannibal was safe both from Scipio, who was camped northwest of Carthage, and from his enemies in the Carthaginian Senate. In the meantime, Scipio won victories over Carthage. And the Carthaginians recognized that they were losing, and they agreed to make peace, but only at first. Then they changed their mind. Hannibal's homecoming did not include a visit to Carthage. In fact, he did not set foot in the capital city until after his final battle with the Romans, a year after his return to Africa. The reason is that Hannibal was always fighting two wars, one against the Romans and the other against his enemies in the Carthaginian government. From the time Hannibal landed in Africa, the Second War, the domestic war, loomed ever larger. His 15 years in Italy gave Hannibal a bitter education in Carthaginian politics. Everyone knew that the Carthaginian Senate played rough, crucifying failed generals, leaving armies in the lurch, making deals behind their generals' backs, even blaming their policies on their generals. Hannibal was nothing if not attuned to threats. He knew the senators would gladly feed him to the wolves. Hannibal had his allies in Carthage. Many Carthaginians were pinning their hopes on him when in spring 202 BC they openly violated the truce with Rome. After seizing the cargo of over 100 shipwrecked Roman transport ships, they tried to kill Roman diplomats. It was all but a declaration of war. Most of Carthage's politicians had, quote, not small hopes, but great hopes that they could win, thanks to Hannibal and his men. The hawks were ascendant in Carthage, and the Romans felt betrayed, and so a fight to the finish was inevitable. Hannibal intended to do his part by building an army. It would not be an easy task. Hannibal did not have enough veteran infantrymen to match Scipio's Roman legionaries, nor did he have Massinissa's cavalry on his side. Yet Hannibal forged ahead. He was building an army with the men he brought with him from Italy. He added his late brother's troops, who were mercenaries, as well as adding local recruits. He found a rival Numidian prince, an enemy of Massinissa, who supplied 2,000 cavalry. Not a huge number, but not nothing. Hannibal also bought wheat and horses. Scipio, meanwhile, contacted Massinissa, the king of Numidia, and he asked him to gather his troops and join him immediately. For his part, Scipio attacked the Carthaginian farming communities of the fertile valley of the Bagradas River, the modern name is the Megerda River. It's important to keep in mind that this area today in Tunisia is not desert, far from it. Its rich soil would be the envy of anyone in the Mediterranean. Anyhow, Scipio stormed the towns of the area and he sold the population into slavery, making a nice profit while terrorizing the locals. The Carthaginian government sent a delegation to Hannibal. They urged him to hurry and bring the matter to a decisive battle. Hannibal did not appreciate being told his craft, so he told the delegation, quote, to look after other matters and rest easy about this one. He would choose the right time himself. A few days later, Hannibal moved his army inland to the vicinity of Zama, a town about 70 miles southwest of the city of Carthage. We know the general area today, but we don't know the exact site. In any case, Scipio was not far away. Now, I've never been to the area of Zama, but I have been to Carthage. What a stunning place, a more mournful and magnificent sight than Carthage you will never see. The harbor is memorable, deep, sheltered, and protected by mountains. You'll have no doubts as to why Carthage became a great maritime power once you cast your eyes on that magnificent harbor. But the ancient citadel of Carthage is gloomy because it was destined ultimately to be destroyed by Rome. If you visit, you can still see arrows and catapult balls, signs of the city's death throes. They're in a small museum at the site. Still, in 202 BC, the end of Carthage was still far off. In 202 BC, it remained possible to imagine that Hannibal might save the city. Let's get back to the pre-battle moves of that year. We have to wonder if the Carthaginian Senate didn't have a point. If Hannibal had moved more quickly, he might in fact, had been able to catch Scipio before Massinissa arrived. Without Massinissa's cavalry, Scipio would have had a difficult time defeating Hannibal. Yet even if Hannibal had reached Scipio in time, he probably wouldn't have been able to force him into battle. Hannibal sent 3 spies to scout the enemy's camp. They were caught by the Romans. But instead of executing them, Scipio did a strange thing. He gave them a tour of the camp, and he returned them to Hannibal with an escort and supplies. Now, this suited the Romans' purpose. While Massinissa and his troops hadn't yet arrived, Scipio knew they were near. He wanted Hannibal to know only that they haven't arrived, because this might tempt him into a trap. By the time Hannibal attacked, Scipio was certain the Numidians would be present. Indeed, they showed up the next day. Now Scipio had his full army. It consisted of 29,000 infantry, almost all of them Romans, and 6,100 cavalry, almost all of them Numidians. Hannibal, on his side, had more infantry. He had 36,000 infantry as opposed to 29,000 Roman infantry. But he had fewer cavalry. Hannibal had 4,000 cavalry. The Romans had 6,100 cavalry. The battle was ready to begin, but not quite yet. First, Hannibal did something extraordinary. He requested a conference with Scipio. Now, folks, this wasn't standard procedure in ancient warfare. Why did it happen? One writer says that Hannibal was so, quote-unquote, amazed at Scipio's, quote, grandeur of soul and audacity in returning the 3 spies that Hannibal, quote, felt an urge to meet him. Another ancient writer says that Hannibal learned of Massinissa's arrival and, quote, was so struck by the enemy's confidence that he decided it was better to parley with Scipio now and, quote, to seek peace while his army was intact and not defeated. Now, in my opinion, neither of those explanations does justice to the complexity of Hannibal. A man of his depth and experience wouldn't request a meeting without thinking it through. And I don't believe he was ready to surrender. He surely assessed the pluses and minuses of this unusual move before deciding to go ahead. A minus: to request the meeting was an admission of weakness on Hannibal's part. It also gave Massinissa and his men time to familiarize themselves with the Roman army and its battle plan. Yet there were advantages. As the older man and a heroic name, Hannibal was 45, Scipio only 32. Given that, Hannibal probably wanted to intimidate his opponent and gather information firsthand. By getting a read on Scipio, by gauging his style and observing his reactions, Hannibal could better prepare for battle. But you know, I think the primary purpose of the meeting was political, and it served several political agendas. Hannibal knew that he stood a good chance of losing the battle. So, okay, he made one last try at a peace treaty. Since Carthage had rejected Scipio's terms, Hannibal took a harder line. While offering to abandon all of Carthage's overseas possessions, as Scipio had required, he said nothing about the navy, about an indemnity, or about grain for Rome's army. No doubt he expected Scipio to reject the offer, but perhaps Hannibal was hoping to bargain. In any case, he might have been playing to the peace party in Carthage. If Hannibal had lost the battle, at least he could say that he had tried diplomacy first. As it turned out, Scipio turned down the terms, which was not a big surprise. It didn't matter, because Hannibal had another more personal agenda. He cared what Scipio thought of him. He didn't want Scipio basing his opinion of him on Carthaginian political slander. He wanted Scipio to see the real Hannibal, and to see him now, before the battle, while they were still equals, and not later when Hannibal might have to come to him on bended knee. The meeting was a private audience. It consisted of just the 2 men and their interpreters. The mood was intimate and intense. Meeting with Scipio was a gesture of respect, the equivalent of 2 boxers touching gloves before the bout. It was a bow to the unwritten code of conduct among fellow warriors. Perhaps it was a reminder, too, that the politicians did not share their camaraderie. Hannibal might have guessed that Scipio, like him, had problems with jealous politicians in his own government. You know, I don't think Hannibal would have had to guess it. I think Hannibal's spies would have confirmed it. I think Hannibal knew it. The meeting was a way of hinting to Scipio that he and Hannibal had much in common. They were not enemies, they were merely opponents, and they could be useful to each other come what may. The meeting was a strategic masterstroke, but the limits of the game went beyond battle. Hannibal was thinking not only of the field at Zama, but also of the post-war world. Hannibal wanted to position himself, lest he seem merely selfish. Consider the lessons of his education in Carthaginian politics. Hannibal was a military man, and yet he had every reason to believe that he could run a wiser, more efficient, and more patriotic republic than the politicians had. That's what 2 decades of commanding Carthage's army had taught him. If Hannibal won the battle, he could exploit a personal relationship with Scipio in the aftermath. Rome would have to decide whether to keep fighting or to accept less generous terms than it had wanted. Hannibal might be able to nudge Scipio in the right direction. And what if Hannibal lost the battle? Well, then, Scipio might help his friend and comrade, Hannibal, to avoid the fate of being shipped off to Rome to march in a Roman victory parade that would climax in Hannibal's execution. By establishing a personal connection with the Roman victor, Hannibal stood to increase his stock in Carthage. By the same token, he could impress on Scipio that Hannibal was the one Carthaginian whom Rome could trust if it had to do business with the enemy. Scipio could argue that Hannibal would be more useful to Rome alive and in Carthage, where he could serve as a voice of moderation, chastened as he had been by his war experience. Finally, there was history. Hannibal knew that if he died in battle and Rome won the war, the enemy would write the history books. When Scipio was interviewed, Hannibal wanted him to remember the man he had met in a tent before battle. On the eve of his last pitched battle, Hannibal paid great attention to the post-war world. Very few generals ever did this. Hannibal wasn't more intelligent than them, but he had experienced a harsher schooling. Ironically, defeat improved Hannibal. But there was still a battle to fight, and it took place the very next morning. It was autumn 202 BC. Zama pitted Carthage's best general against Rome's best general, neither of whom had ever lost a major battle. The whole long, drawn-out Second Punic War that had been going on since 218 BC. This 16-year-long war between Rome and Carthage came down to this one day. Livy highlights the drama of the occasion. The two most famous generals, the two most powerful armies of the two richest nations upon earth came to do battle, destined either to double or destroy the countless battle honors that they had previously won. Livy goes on to describe, or probably to imagine, what each general said to his troops. Here he is on Hannibal. Quote, "The Carthaginian reminded his men of all they had achieved in Italy over the 16 years, all the Roman generals they had slain, all the armies they had destroyed. And as he came to individual soldiers, heroes of particular battles, he would remind them of the honors each had won." And here is Livy on Scipio. He has Scipio say the following, quote, "This war is coming to an end. Our toil is almost done. The wealth of Carthage lies within our grasp. We're going back, my soldiers, to our parents, our children, our wives, and all the gods of home." Livy goes on to say, the author Celsus tells us that as Scipio spoke, his whole stance and demeanor were so uplifted, so transported with happiness, that you might have thought that he had already won the day. The ancient sources emphasize the excitement of the occasion, and yet Zama lacks the razzle-dazzle of Cannae, or of the Battle of Alipa in Spain, where Scipio had launched a similarly bold maneuver as Hannibal at Cannae. At Zama, there were no flank attacks. Why did Hannibal and Scipio each give up his trademark maneuver? My guess is that they each wanted to keep the other off balance by doing the unexpected. Hannibal displayed particular audacity in his deployments. Hannibal knew that he stood at a disadvantage against Scipio, who had a better army. Scipio outnumbered Hannibal in cavalry and in experience veteran infantrymen. Hannibal had more infantrymen overall, but most of them were new recruits. And as we've said before, in ancient battles, having veterans gives you a huge advantage. Nonetheless, Hannibal put his ever-fertile mind to the problem, and he came up with an ingenious solution. Contrary to his usual practice, Hannibal organized his army in three lines. The Romans, too, arranged their army in three lines, but Hannibal's lines were different. In the Roman deployment, the first line consisted of the youngest men. The second line contained the most experienced and mature men. And in the third line, there were the oldest soldiers, men slightly past their prime. Normally, it was the first two lines who really fought a battle. The third line joined the mix only when the going got very rough. There's a Latin saying that says, roughly, we're going to the third line, meaning we're really desperate. In Hannibal's order of battle, the plan was just the opposite. And everything would come down to the third line. They wanted to go to the third line. It worked like this. Hannibal's first line consisted of mercenaries. These were the men who had fought in Italy with Hannibal's brother. The second line was made up of recruits drawn from Carthage and the North African countryside. So these were raw troops. The job of these first two lines was to get the Romans bloody and tired, to blunt the edge of their swords from overuse, and to break up the order of the Romans' deployment. But they were not good enough soldiers to defeat the Romans. That was the job of the third line. So who was in the third line? The third line consisted of men who had come back from Italy with Hannibal. These were a mix of Italians, of Celts from the Po River Valley of Italy, and of Spaniards, Numidians, and other Africans. In other words, the third line included men who had marched with Hannibal from the very beginning of the war. These were his best troops. These were the proud men. Some of them had crossed the Alps and fought at the Ticinus and the Trebia and Trasimene and then at Cannae. These were the veterans of Italy. Hannibal planned to use them to defeat the Romans after his first two lines had softened them up. They would stand their ground fresh and firm and beat back the Romans' attack. But the bigger problem was Scipio's superiority in cavalry. With his combination of Italian cavalry and Numidia's magnificent horsemen, Scipio could take Hannibal's army in the flanks and the rear the way Hannibal had taken the Roman army at Cannae. Hannibal knew that he needed to stop that from happening, and so he employed two strategies, elephants and decoys. Hannibal had more than 80 elephants with him at Zama. Hannibal deployed the elephants in front of his first line, hoping to use them to break up the enemy's well-ordered formation. Imagine how terrifying the charge of 80 elephants was. Yet, as the battle began, it didn't work. Some of the elephants panicked at the sound of the trumpets and turned and trampled some of Hannibal's cavalry units. Some other elephants simply stampeded off the battlefield. A third group of elephants charged the Romans and killed some light-armed troops, but otherwise they did little damage. In fact, Scipio was prepared. He had arranged alley-like gaps between his legionary formations, and his men funneled the attacking beasts down those alleys. Hannibal's elephants failed. Now came the turn of Scipio's cavalry. He placed his cavalry, as usual, on his flanks, with the Romans and the Italians on his right and the Numidians on his left. Scipio ordered them to charge the much outnumbered cavalry on Hannibal's flanks. In response, Hannibal's horsemen turned and fled, with the enemy in hot pursuit. For a long time, there simply were no cavalry on the battlefield. This was the decoy. My guess is that Hannibal planned things this way, hoping to win the infantry battle before the enemy horse returned. Once they did return, he could form his men up in squares to ward the cavalry off, so he would not be vulnerable the way the Roman infantry had been at Cannae. That's the plan. How did it work out? It all came down to the infantry. Things went according to Hannibal's plan. His first two lines, the mercenaries and the North Africans, got in some good blows before the Romans savaged them and drove them off the field. They left so many corpses and discarded weapons on the battlefield after this first phase of the fighting that the Romans had a hard time wading through them without slipping on the blood-stained ground. But they forged ahead in order to reach Hannibal's third lines, his veterans. It was a moment of the highest drama. Veterans of Cannae stood on both sides. For the Romans, it was a grudge fight. For the Carthaginians, it was a final chance to save everything. Let's hear from the great Polybius about what happened next. The two phalanxes closed with the greatest eagerness and ardor. As they were nearly equal in numbers, as well as in spirit and bravery, and were equally well-armed, the contest was for a long time doubtful, the men falling where they stood out of determination. And then Scipio's horsemen, returning from the pursuit of the Carthaginian cavalry, arrived providentially at the proper moment. When they fell on Hannibal's army from the rear, most of the men were cut down in their ranks, while of those who took to flight, only quite a few escaped, as the cavalry were close on them and the country was level. So think about it. Hannibal is at a disadvantage, but he comes up with this very unusual, very unconventional plan, and he almost pulls it off. He almost defeats the Roman infantry in time to regroup and protect his army from the Roman cavalry. But unfortunately for Hannibal, he just runs out of time. He doesn't pull it off. And the enemy cavalry arrives in the rear to crush Hannibal's army, attacking from the rear, cutting down most of his men in the ranks. And so it's a defeat. It's a slaughter. It's Cannae in reverse. When the Battle of Zama was over, the Carthaginians had about 20,000 dead and almost as many taken prisoner. The Romans had only about 1,500 dead. Yes, I know these are very lopsided figures and they might cause a certain amount of incredulity. And yet, this sometimes happened in ancient battles. When you won, you won. And when you lost, you lost. Scipio won a crushing victory. For Hannibal, it was his first defeat in a pitched battle, but it was a decisive defeat. Hannibal has been criticized for not using his third line to attack Scipio's flanks at Zama. The critics also blame him for not regrouping his elephants or the survivors of the first two lines to screen off the rear and flanks of his third line. You know, I think Hannibal thought of these moves, and I think if he didn't do them, it's because he concluded that his men lacked either the numbers or experience to pull them off. I trust Polybius, our great historian of Hannibal and his wars, and Polybius says that Hannibal was admirable at Zama. He did everything in the battle that a good general with a great deal of practical experience could possibly have done. So again, I see this. I see Zama, although it's a defeat for Hannibal, I see it as a tribute to what he could do in a very, very difficult situation, almost pulling off success. After the defeat, Hannibal galloped back to the coast at Hadrumetum, over 120 miles away, abandoning what was left of his army. Shortly afterwards, the Carthaginian Senate sent an embassy to Scipio to sue for peace. Scipio's terms weren't much harsher than the ones that Carthage had earlier accepted and then rejected. Carthage had to abandon all its overseas possessions. It had to pay an indemnity and supply grain for Scipio's troops. But the indemnity was doubled from what the Romans had offered before, and Carthage had to lose its navy and its elephants. It could not make war outside Africa, and it needed Roman approval even before making war in Africa. Also, the peace terms licensed Massinissus, the king of Numidia, to harass Carthage by making an open-ended demand that Carthage, quote-unquote, restore his ancestral possessions. In Carthage, the Senate debated the theory. In spite of everything, there were war hawks. But they had to deal with an unexpected politician, Hannibal. For the first time in 35 years, Hannibal returned to the city of his birth And there, he engaged in another kind of warfare, political warfare. Hannibal took part in the debate. He literally dragged an opponent of the treaty from the speaker's platform. The senators were aghast. And Hannibal apologized for his rough and undiplomatic behavior, but he explained that he'd been spending most of his life in the field. He made his point. After Zama, he said, all was lost, hopelessly lost. There was nothing left for the Carthaginians except to bow to Scipio's terms. And so they did. In the following year, 201 BC, the peace terms formally went into effect. After 17 years, the Second Punic War was over. If we look back, by invading Italy in 218 BC, Hannibal had made one of the boldest gambles in military history. He won one of the most famous battlefield victories of all time, Cannae. But Hannibal ran up against one of the most dangerous and adaptable enemies, Rome. And he also ran up against Scipio, a genius. It's a tribute to Roman society that a man like Scipio was able to emerge. Scipio proceeded by steps. In Italy, he tested Hannibal's mettle. Then he learned from the Carthaginian and proved himself in Spain. Finally, Scipio went to Africa, and he brought the war home to the enemy. At Zama, he achieved his military masterpiece. Hannibal eventually ended up in exile, and in due time, he was forced to commit suicide. As for Scipio, he was honored with a new title, Africanus, the African. Scipio Africanus is how history remembers him. Thanks for listening, everyone. Next time, join me for a look at the Battle of Pharsalus, a famous struggle not between a Roman and a Carthaginian, but a struggle between two Romans in a civil war, between Caesar and Pompey. We'll be discussing that on the next episode of Antiquitas. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.